It's been a long getting her here.
You say no or
I don't know how many months.
Oh, yeah. 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 Yeah.
I like tea at night.
Good, I'm glad. Hi, everybody. I'm Denise, and I'm a very, 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 very grateful for covering alcohol.
Hi, Denise.
Hi, Denise.
I'm so glad to be here today and with this wonderful, warm, generously loving group of people. Tell God's with me. Two things that were said to me is Michael told me, don't worry about it. It's like being in the living room with your friends. And then Kathleen said, it doesn't matter what you say, I love you anyway. Those were my two messages yesterday in preparing for this. So, and then many of you have given me some warm greetings. Also, this morning I was getting ready, and all of a sudden I was getting really nervous, like physically nervous. And I went, that's so weird. I'm going to grab my phone and put on some soft music. And I grabbed the phone, and guess what? Marguerite had texted me and sent me music from her church.
Oh,
and it was John's granddaughter that was the lead singing.
Wow.
These are the kinds of things that happen in my life. You know, the synchronicity of the higher power coming through. I took a workshop a long time ago, probably had 5 years of sobriety, and we were asked, if your life ended today, what would be your epitaph? What would people say? And I remember back then saying, came right away, I said, she was divinely led. And I really feel that today, too. I can even see more of it when I go in hindsight 2020. And see what's gone in the past and see the things that have come into my life since recovery and even prior to recovery of getting me to the point of knowing that I'm an alcoholic. I could see God's hand in all of it. And so here we go. A little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. So I think you got a clue about what it's like today already. Sneak preview. I'm the daughter of Clark Davis and Jean Davis. My mother was 100% Irish. My father was 100% Polish. His real name was Emil Nowakowski. He changed his name. And we grew up, I was born in Buffalo, New York, and I lived there till I was age 7. And then we moved to Ohio. I had a whole new beginning, and I'll get into that. And then spent most of my time in Ohio. Went to school there, parochial schools till 12th grade, Ohio University, where my drinking started down in Athens, Ohio, and then got married to my former husband that met at a fraternity party. You get the gist of where that was going. Just lots of drinking, and that was our relationship. And then we got transferred to Chicago and in 1985. And then came out here in 1988. So I've been out in California since 1988. But in that family of with my mother and father, we had 6 children. I'm the middle child. I'm the only girl. I have 5 brothers. Growing up in the house, I questioned a lot. Why was I born? What was I here for? And it wasn't until I walked into these rooms that I heard my primary purpose was to stay sober and help other alcoholics. And I knew I found my true hope. And that is still true today. When I was going up in grade school and that, I really did have a belief in a faith in a higher power. I think somewhere along the line, once the drinking started in college, I abandoned my higher power. I remember making a decision not to go to church anymore. I remember getting a lot of self-will, deciding what I wanted to do. That's where I got really duly addicted for the next 13 years of my life. I started, of course, my first drinking. I didn't drink until I was 18, although I have to tell you a funny story. I guess I had a drink when I was under 5. I don't know how old I was, but it was from my grandma, my Polish grandma. She lived downstairs, and we lived upstairs, the 3 older of us. And one day my mom said, would you watch the kids? She had to go do some stuff. And so she was making lunch for us. And we were drinking our milk, and we go, ooh, Grandma, the milk tastes funny. She said, just drink it. We found out later she had whiskey in the water. And she did that because she wanted us all to crash, fall asleep, and she didn't have to take care of us. So my mother was so mad. The other interesting part about this grandma, or this history of this grandma, she had speakeasies back in the days of the Prohibition. She came on the boat when she was 17 over from Poland, Austria-Poland, I guess at the time, and she her parents had to stay behind, and she was one of those people that immigrated here because of the horrible war and everything. Anyway, I guess my aunt told me that they'd come home from school often and say, "Where's Ma?" And somebody'd say, "Well, she was arrested again today." Oh, wow. You know, so that's a kind of thing. Alcohol was around and alive in my life. The Irish side of the family, if any of you have Irish relatives or grew up in an Irish family, this is how Irish get-togethers go. You sit down and get big table, big round table, probably as big as this room at my Grandma McDonald's house. We go every Sunday. My grandma had 11 kids. And everybody would bring their kids to Grandma McDonald's on Sunday. And they'd start talking, and then pretty soon after food was done, Irish songs, singing. And then all of a sudden, somebody would get, you know, they're drinking Canadian ale the whole time. And as soon as somebody got a little bit too much, topics of religion, topics of politics came out. Everybody started fighting. The only person who wasn't at that table was my godmother, my Aunt Margaret, and she was in the other room playing the player piano and trying to keep those kids interested. And I'd always be that kid who was peeking around the corner thinking, that's what I want to do when I get older. I like that round table and all that drinking. And that was my first awareness that something they had was something I wanted. And and then they'd grab their kids, go home, and the next Sunday we would all come back again. So alcohol was around the church school community that I was part of in Ohio, St. Mary's. They had socials. There was always drinking. We had a couple alcoholic priests were in our parish. So, I mean, but I didn't think anything. I didn't think of anything. I thought of alcoholics just like a lot of us did, that they were people who just wore trench coats and were going to die in the gutter, you know, and there was nothing you could do about it. And when I started drinking in college, I drank because I was full of a lot of fear. I know that. I also drank because it worked. But my very first drink was when I moved into the dorm and somebody said, "Put down your suitcase, let's go. There's a freshman tea." And at Ohio University, a tea was a keg of beer in a pitcher, like a Kool-Aid pitcher. And the red cups, and you could have as many as you want for a dollar at the door. So that was my first introduction to the bar life in Athens, Ohio, and it was a blast. So part of the reason I drank was just because it was so much fun in the beginning, and I felt, and all that fear that I had and didn't know what to do with or who I was or who I was about just vanished when I took those. It was miraculous, I think, for us alcoholics, that we find this substance that changes us so much. Maybe not so much for other people because they don't want to get a little bit too drunk or something, but for us it's like, give me more of that. So anyway, that was my first introduction to drinking. But then I got, someone said to me, "You should try these little white crosses, they're great. You could stay up all night, you could drink more, you'll study better, blah blah blah." So whoever, I used to think, why didn't they have billboards saying that? Everybody was looking to have more energy, do more things, study harder, drink harder, you know. So anyway, that became a constant focus of my addiction, too. I can't believe the places, especially after I was married and lived in Ohio, where I traveled to go find a doctor who would give me black beauties or a person. I mean, I really did my homework, and I looked for them, and I never was. If I started, I would count them. I don't know about any of you, but I count them and make sure I had enough. And when they were starting to go down, I had to go. But it was always alcohol. When I finally came to terms with the fact that I was an alcoholic, my ex-husband didn't even know that that was going on with me. I said, when he denied that I was an alcoholic, I said, "Wait a minute, I got to show you something." And I went around and I got the pile of pills in the baggie, and I brought up this literally a grocery bag full of pot that I didn't really prefer pot, but I had it just in case nothing else was around. So I kept buying it, and I had quite a bit. And I didn't even use it. But that's how crazy it is when we're addicted, I believe. After college, I got married to my ex-husband. He was in a fraternity. I was in a sorority. We had dated for 3 years. My parents looked at us one day when he was over, and he said, now what are you guys going to do that you're going to, Denise is graduating, and what are you going to do? We kind of looked at each other and said, I guess we'll get married. Not a big romantic thing, not even sure we even understood what we were getting into. I've talked to a lot of people. I didn't have that pause when agitated or doubtful. I didn't have any of those tools. All I knew is this is a good way to get out of the house for both of us. We can change each other. We didn't say that to each other, but we thought it. And we entered in on June 23rd, 1973. We entered into a marriage of craziness in Ohio. And it was a huge wedding. You know, being the only girl, we had, I mean, I'm too embarrassed to tell you how many, but there was a lot of people. And you could tell people knew what we were about. Our gifts were drinking glasses, wine decanters, party trays. I mean, everything. When I was moving out of my house after our divorce in Danville, my sponsor would say, what are all these boxes with glasses and party trays and 50 ice buckets we got, too. And I said, those are wedding gifts we still haven't been able to use. So somebody at Goodwill had a really good anyway, that was how crazy. But our drinking, we invited all the people from our college up on the weekends. By that time, some of our college friends were buying their first house, and we were like, we didn't have the money to buy a first house because all our money was going for alcohol and drugs and whatever and entertainment. So all of a sudden, we were married a couple years, and I realized I was pregnant with our first daughter. And I was shocked because I hadn't planned it. We hadn't talked about it. I kept it to myself for about 3 weeks. I didn't even want to tell my husband because I was like, what in the heck am I going to do? And because the bigger reason was the inside voice said, how are you going to take care of this child when you can't take care of yourself? I heard it that clearly. And I went, you're right. I don't know. So I sat with it, but eventually we talked about it, and I told the parents. Everybody was so excited. I got, I guess, addicted to the excitement others had for me. I really did. And I was joyful, and I met another teacher that taught. I taught special ed at that time. When I moved to Akron area where we had our home, I got a job teaching at Field Local Schools, which is down the street from Kent, Ohio. And my ex worked for Firestone. He was in the tire building. He was an engineer, and he worked for them. So we had this house out in the country. We had the darling little daughter that I didn't drink through. I met a friend who taught at the junior high, and she was pregnant at the same time. We made a pact that we would go to happy hour, but we wouldn't drink. Because happy hour was a big deal for me. If you knew me, you'd be coming to happy hour. If you were my friend, you better be at that happy hour. Fridays, every Friday, happy hour. I'd even go around and knock on all the teachers' doors and say, come in happy hour, come in happy hour. Some of the best ones were the math and science teachers. They just would look at me like, you are crazy, lady. And but I was so proud when we would get a full table there. And anyway, that was a big, big thing for me. The part of that was not so great was, I would tell my husband to come meet me. And of course, when you're drinking starting at 3 p.m. when school gets out and he gets out at 5, guess what? We were gone somewhere else. And that happened a couple times, and finally he said, okay, this is the deal. You stay out of Akron, I'll stay out of Kent. You drink there, I'll drink here. I mean, isn't that great for marriage? That's our Friday night. So that's what happened. And things, of course, got crazier and crazier and crazier. And eventually, I at that time was suffering quite a bit from this disease, you can imagine. And it was really starting to catch up with me. My physical appearance was changing, my attitude, I could tell I was really crabby. You know, I was irritable, restless, irritable, and discontented, right? That's who I was. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. I had been a pretty happy kid growing up. I had, you know, even though I didn't know anything, I was pretty social, and I was finding myself more and more embarrassed to run into people that I knew. I would go home to, my parents lived about an hour and a half away, and I'd go home and I'd be in a convenience store, and they'd have those mirrors in the back by the coolers, and you could see who's in the store. I'd check them out to make sure that nobody I knew was in the store at the same time, because I knew I had changed. And I didn't know how to say what was wrong with me, because I didn't even know. And I would ask people, what do you think it is? I'd ask my mother, I'd ask her to go out to lunch with me. What do you think's wrong with me? Never thought about the drinking, never said the drinking. Nobody ever asked about the drinking. It was just a norm in the way that I grew up in that. So anyway, I all of a sudden heard that two people in our school district were going to this workshop. They had already gone, people from Hazleton had come and taught about drug and alcohol abuse, or talked about it as a disease. This is 1982, okay? In the 70s, they were just starting to maybe think teenagers needed to go to treatment. So all we used to do is send them home, and they would be latchkey kids, and they'd drink more. We had, like, no way of helping people. So this workshop was really helpful. And I went to this workshop with my school's principal. I taught at the junior high at that time. And we went to this 3 hours of training at this place called Rockbridge, Ohio, right outside of Akron. And I went to this training, and the very first lecture, all that, when I said I was divinely led, I used to sit outside and look up at this beautiful tree and say, what is it? If there's a higher power, if there's a God, please, please help me. I don't know what's wrong with me. So we go to this workshop, and before we went in, the rules were, if you cannot drink, or if you have a prescription, come see us, because we're all using or drinking during this week of training. So I thought, wow, what a novel idea. I never thought of not drinking. Okay, we'll do this. So the woman who said it too, somehow, you know how you have this connection with somebody? I liked what she said or how she said it. Anyway, I love this lady. Anyway, we went into the lecture hall. It was stadium seating. I sat in the very back row next to the school principal. And the guy down at the end, of course, very good-looking guy, but as soon as he said, I'm a recovering alcoholic and drug addict, I went, loser! You know? I thought, well, this guy had nothing to tell me. I had seen the disease. You know, here I am, the egomaniac with the inferiority complex. Here's a person falling apart, drinking, looking in the rearview mirror on a Friday night going, what the heck's wrong with you? How did you get here? Who are you? I would have these conversations with myself. And I'm calling him a loser. So, but he was a blessing in disguise, too. He was such a blessing. He was the very first person who told me exactly what was going on with me. And I wish I could find him, because it was amazing. He said, people who use and drink like this, and he described the disease of alcoholism as a feeling disease, that we start where we have fun, and then we have fun with problems, and we have problems, and we used to feel normal, meaning you can't do anything if you don't have that substance in you. And I went, ding, 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 that's me. I can't even go to the grocery store without having a drink in me. I can't do anything. We can't go out socially without a drink. And I was always taking the speed every day, because you could imagine after many years of speed, you needed a few more just to stay awake. Anyway, he said, people who are like this are not bad, they're sick. And I went, whoa. And then he said to me, here are the symptoms of alcoholism. And here is the recovery that you have for alcoholism. And I just wanted to cry. I was like, I had been desperately seeking this information. And it was being handed to me in the form of a workshop where the big book talks about sometimes a spiritual awakening is out of an educational variety. Well, there it was. I was being educated to what the heck was wrong with me for the past 31 years of my life, that I had this disease that I didn't see. And my family didn't see, because we were all part of it, right? We're part of the big secret, the elephant in the room, right? So anyway, went through that training, and by Thursday of that week, I couldn't wait to get back. By the way, my daughter was at my parents' house. My husband was on a business trip, so every time I went home that evening, I had the house to myself. Can you imagine having all that information and having that time to yourself? It was so precious to process what I had just heard that day. Every day I'd get up, I'd be so excited to go and learn more. I didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell Mr. Smith, hey, you're talking about me, I'm the alcoholic. You know, I'm your special ed teacher, but I'm an alcoholic, too. I didn't want to give that away. Yeah. but anyway, so the workshops were just fascinating. Each one of those topics I could see myself in, and especially the one with how you affect the person you live with. And I could see what my daughter must be going through. I could see what my husband must be going through. Because they say the person that lives with the alcoholic sometimes is crazier than the alcoholic, because we're feeding them lie after lie after lie, and we're thinking, why aren't you taking that, you know, why aren't you getting that, you know, and just denying things, looking at people straight in the eye. And so anyway, by the fourth day, towards the end of that workshop, we sat in small groups. And I had this group of 8 professionals. I had a minister. I had a person who was in the National Council on Alcoholism. I had a couple other teachers, therapists, all these wonderful people. And we sat around in a group where we were supposed to talk about our use. And the first 2 guys went, and they hardly drank at all. They might have had beer here and there, but they weren't really into drinking a lot. And I went, oh, shit. I was going to tell everybody what was going on with me. And I went, you're going to have to lie, Denise. They can't handle this. Nobody even understands. And I went to say, when it was my turn, a lie. And the words came out, I'm an alcoholic. And I went like this to them, and they looked like this to me. And I put my head down, and I sobbed. And I felt gates open, light come down. Something was happening beyond my wildest imagination. And the woman that I told you I like so much, she said to me, honey, don't you worry about anything. That's pain you didn't know what to do with, and you're going to be just fine. We'll talk to you after this. So that group, what I learned is when we get here or anywhere, if we tell our truth, people aren't running away. People aren't going like, I'm not talking to her. They come closer. They want to know more. You know, this whole thing about it, it's so ironic. It's like the more honest we are about our disease, the more we have, the more love and support in this group. Anyway, going on, after that workshop, I had to see this counselor. So I went to see this counselor, and I said to her, Emily, I'm supposed to see you on Tuesday. This is Thursday. I said, I'm supposed to see you on Tuesday. I have one question. Should I drink one more time before I come see you, or should I just come see you? She said, honey, you're a real alcoholic to answer that, ask that question. She had been there when I you know, realized that I had admitted to everyone. She said, you had just admitted you'll have a week of sobriety. You do what you want. When I found out I was alcoholic, I called AA and I said, pick me up tomorrow. I'm going to go out and drink one last time. And she said, all it gave me was a horrible headache. So she said, do what you want to do. So that weekend was tough. I went home. First person I saw was my husband at the time. He said, oh, how was the workshop? I said, well, I thought I was alcoholic. And he goes, no, you're not. You just drink too much. I said, no, I'm an alcoholic. And I said, and the reason I know that I'm an alcoholic is because I had said it to my innermost self. When your heart knows your truth, nobody can talk you out of it. I know I'm an alcoholic. And I know I'm very addicted to pills, too. And I've been blessed with that lately. Every narcotic that I've gotten for surgeries or something, I throw up. So I can't even use them anymore. That's been a blessing. So anyway, I knew I was. And I just told them, too, that you may want to seek Al-Anon. Anyway, then I went to go pick up my daughter. And they said, make sure you ask Jen, your daughter Jen, what mommy was like when she drank. Some of you have heard this story. And so I saw Jen. First, I saw my mom. And my mom said, well, how was the workshop? And I told her, well, I thought I was alcoholic. Oh, boy. I got yelled at so bad. For here's the one daughter of the family. She's coming clean. This is going to change everything. They had that one friend that was in their card club, Dave, that was alcoholic. And they always kind of talked about poor Dave. And here, my daughter saying this. And my mom said, why did you always have to have a drink in your hand? I said, Mom, there's more to it than that. When I'm prepared to talk about it, we'll talk more. My dad overheard the conversation, and he immediately looked at me, went out on the front porch, and pouted. He did not want to talk about it because he also had the disease. And he kept it under control the best he could. And it came out a little more when we got college age, and we'd come home, and he'd be so excited because he could buy all the booze he wanted because it's for the kids, you know. And so he liked drinking with me. And then Jen, I said, Jen, I'm supposed to ask you what mommy was like when she drank. She goes, oh, mommy, you were so much fun. You let me do whatever I wanted to do. So in Jen's world, I could have kept drinking forever. Just go out the neighborhood. Go ahead. Have some kids over. I don't care. Whatever, you know. It was just so I could keep drinking. So, but anyway, so that started my road to recovery. And I found out that the meetings that were closest to my home, I wasn't connecting. And so they suggested that I go out to where the young people were in this town of Fairlawn in Akron area. And I start going to meetings there. And I'm so blessed there because the way they did it is they had a beginner's meeting for a half hour, and they went over slogans, types of meetings, sponsorship, all the basics. And then you went to your women's meeting or your men's meeting, and then they had Ellen on there too. So anyway, so I started going to that meeting regularly, and I remember there was one time where I went to meet a friend of mine that I used to drink with, and my car ended up pulling into my sponsor's driveway, and I didn't even plan on it. And I was another divinely guided. And I came in the house, I said, Gail, I'm supposed to go meet so-and-so. They go, come on, let's call him right here. I'll be right here with you. You're going to be fine. This is where we have to start changing, you know, the neurotransmitters, the kind of like the brain, where what's the response to this? And so she helped me call, and that was that. Then I started, another time I was going to happy hour, because you know how happy hour was so precious to me, and drinking Diet Coke with my teacher, fellow teachers. And a guy in the back of the room said, you're not supposed to be going to happy hours now. That's not going to be helpful to you. And I just felt really kind of embarrassed, but I talked to him afterwards and I got it. It wasn't a good place for me to be, and he just was trying to be protective. Anyway, I was in Akron for the 3 years of my recovery. I had a wonderful sponsor. She ended up being the one who started the Archive Museum. She's a wonderful lady. She taught me a lot about alcoholism. She confronted me. She wasn't afraid of me. She wasn't afraid to tell me how she saw it. The first thing she did one time was, I was just sitting in the meeting, and she looks over at me. She goes, quit judging. What are you saying that for? She goes, I can tell it in your eyes. You're like looking at these people. And she said, I watch you from now on when you look at somebody and you have a judgment about them. You do not leave looking at them till you can find one thing you like about them. So that started changing that pattern. And she would have us all at her house once a month. And she taught us the family history and the sisterhood of sobriety. So then my husband at the time went to Al-Anon, and she met him in Al-Anon because her family was very alcoholic, and he came up and said, you know, you're Denise's husband, and what do you think? He goes, well, I don't like her going to so many meetings, and she set him straight. She goes, listen, she needs these. You need to let her go. And he wanted me to go to one meeting a week, and she said, no less than three, and she needs to do this, and it will in time get better. So during that time, I have to say our marriage started getting a little better. And we actually ended up, I started having some more quiet time. Started where the steps were phenomenal with Gail. I admitted, this is the way she'd have me do the steps. You'd read the step in the 12 and 12 big book. You would write about it. I would share it with her. And then when I'd call her, she'd say, okay, we just finished step one. How do you apply what you're just going through to step one? Because it could work for anything in your life. And she would have me do that. And we would go down the steps that way. And it took me a long time in step. I could see the insanity because I could see the unmanageability before I could see what I had was a disease. But step three really stopped me for a while. I didn't have that loving concept of a higher power that I wanted. So it took me a little bit of time. And I would say I probably took my fourth step a year after I got in. And it was, of course, after I had shared this at a meeting this week that I went up to a woman and I said, what do you think is wrong with blah, 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 blah? She goes, have you done your fourth step? And I said, no. She goes, that's what you need. You need to do a fourth step. I went, okay. So I said, Gail, we need to do a fourth step. So I appeared at her house on December 22nd, I'll never forget, at 10 o'clock with my fourth step to do our fifth. And she spent 3 hours with me, and it was the most amazing time. We cried. We laughed. I came clean with what my part in for all those resentments that I had. And it was funny when she told me about the resentment part, she had me get a 3-portion notebook and she said, put resentments here, fears here, sexual inventory here. She said, I better be on that resentment list. And I went, really? She said, yeah, I know you don't like everything I have to say. And so be honest about it and we'll talk about it. So anyway, and then my fears, there were like 35 fears and then all the sexual inventory. And she, when we were finished, I felt so good. But she said, honey, you're so Catholic that you need to do this with a priest now. She said, you need to go and see in the eyes of the church and before a man that you are still okay for who you are. Because there was so much pressure growing up in the household with guys and all their friends and everything. And being teased. I was always taller than everybody. Got a lot of teasing when I was younger. And so always worried enough, little about stuff. Low self-esteem in those areas. So I went and I found the Catholic priest in this country church And we spent two evenings. We did the resentments and the fears, and then we did the sexual inventory in the second one. And his words to me, oh, my God, girl, God has forgiven you so long ago. Get out there and enjoy your life. You're fine. And I felt so at peace. And it was beautiful. I walked out on the front porch of this little country church. It was the first snowfall. I felt as clean as that snow. And it was just beautiful. And so that was a big part of getting through those steps. I would have to say with steps 6 and 7, I really worked at that for a long time and seeing how I could let go of what I was doing. And Gail was really great at helping me and pointing those out when they showed up. She was helpful with that. And then, of course, the 8th and 9th, when I had to get ready to make amends, I realized my name was on the top of that list. I heard recently that grieving, that feeling of grieving, is this feeling of love that you could not express to the person that you're grieving, the thing you're grieving. It's like you have so much, you're just feeling all this. And I was grieving the loss of me. I didn't have me. I lost me. I left me. And I abandoned me. And I let everybody else's opinions and everything out there kind of control and decide who I was. And I was so sad that this person, but I knew when I heard no matter how far down the scale you go, you'll see your experience will benefit another. I knew, oh my God, I'm going to be okay. Because all this stuff I just shared with Gail, I'm going to be able to give help some woman. And I may not have stories like some of you guys, but I know your feelings. I know how you feel. I know the stuff we go through. I've sat in enough meetings. I've heard enough stories. I've been on the other side of 5 steps. I understand, and it all comes through being able to be honest with myself first and seeing me. And I also know that I've learned that if I make decisions from my thought system, often they're based on fear. If I give a moment, pause and agitate it off, I'll go to my heart, even hold on to my heart, and they come from love. That to me, the what I started getting from my higher power was love messages. So here we go. This is the next part where I'm in this marriage that isn't going anywhere. It's getting worse. We had it, when he lived in Chicago, I have to say, we joined Couples Anonymous, and it was a great time. We even were asked to come back to Akron on Founders Day and share as a couple. So that was a great, wonderful experience. But all of a sudden, we get to California, and he came out here 6 months before me. And we're waiting for a house to be built. And our marriage just... He started seeing other people. He started, you know, the job, everything that was around California was so new and from the Midwest. And anyway, our relationship took a toll. And I told him I'd stick with him if he wanted to get through this. And it just got worse. And finally, I was standing looking at him one day when once again some rage came over him. And the inside voice said, I think it's time you leave. And I went, you're right. And that message in me was the one, and I knew in my heart this was the right message. So I told him we really need to get divorced. He was shocked. He goes, I never thought you'd leave me. And I'm going, oh, my gosh. It was so painful. And he said, how come you're so addicted to AA? And I said, honey, I'm not addicted to AA. It was the most, I said, if I am addicted, I have to thank you. Because I went to meetings and worked this program so hard so I could have some sanity because our home life was so crazy. And, of course, he didn't like that answer, but that was the truth. You know, it was the place I went, and I got sanity, and I got to grow, and I got to be who I was, and I got to learn more about myself and other people, and I got to get out of myself and help other people when my life was painful. And so we got divorced. It was very, very difficult. And I remember 22 years of marriage. And even though you're the one who wants it or thinks it's the right thing, it's not easy. Any breakup is not easy. And it was very painful. And to see the kids to have to go through that. By that time, I had a second child. We had had Nikki. I had 3 years of sobriety. And Nikki wasn't supposed to be born because of some physical ailment in my body. And the doctor said, if you have faith, use it. And I asked everybody to pray. And I told the story before, but she was born perfectly well. And the doctor looked up at me and said, the physical condition you have no longer exists. You had a physical miracle. So he said, whatever faith you have, keep it up. So these are the kinds of things that were happening and in spite of the craziness in our marriage. So we moved out. After we moved out here to California and we got divorced, it was a whole different world for me. I had never been on my own. I had parents who helped me through college. I got right into a marriage, you know, and all of a sudden I'm I'm like, how do I afford to do this? How do I, I'm working part-time at the time, and luckily some miracles happen around work. I'm at a meeting, I tell people I have to get back to work. This woman comes up to me, and like I hadn't seen her for 3 months, and then she comes up to me and she goes, did you get a job yet? And I said, no. She goes, here's my card, come see me. And she worked where I was working, and eventually, and she said, I think I have a job for you. And it was a nice little part-time job. But from that part-time job, it grew into a part-time job with benefits. And then from that, I was in that job for 9 months, and I applied for another job, and I got that job, and it ended up being 30 years of that career with benefits and being a manager, and it was very sufficient. And my sponsor just kept saying, trust God with the money. Like, I have this wonderful sponsor who just says, you can't fear money, it'll just keep you stuck. Just keep believing that it'll come, and it has. Money has showed up when it was necessary. So I was able to buy a home for my kids, and we had apartments and stuff along the way. At first, I rented a home because I wanted them to be in a neighborhood and not be, I wanted them to feel like their life hadn't changed as drastically as it had. And that worked nice for a while, and then we moved on to a couple other places. But anyway, we all survived that. And we sat down the first time we had, Easter came after divorce, and they said, what are we going to do? And we had to regroup as a team of three of us and say, how are we going to do holidays? How are we going to do vacations? How are we going to do whatever? It's the three of us. And I'll tell you today, we are still very close. It's the three of us and everybody else with us, our friends and family. And they're just wonderful, wonderful young ladies. And I had two incidents, one with the oldest daughter that was at a dance and almost died of lethal alcoholism poisoning because she didn't understand alcohol, because since the age of six, we had it in our home. And she was found some booze and put it in a Cobb Mountain water bottle and had about 14 ounces of Jack Daniels, and decided when her friends didn't come out to meet her outside, she drank the whole thing. And luckily the school principal, assistant principal, found her in the bathroom and took her to the emergency room. And she called me, and I called my sponsor. It was days of payphone. I called my sponsor and said, we got to get to the emergency room. And the doctor came out and said, who's Mrs. Phoenix? I said, I am. And he said, you're a very lucky mother tonight. Your daughter could have died with one more half ounce of alcohol in her body. Her heart would have stopped. That was very scary. I had to go through that without my husband. Then the next thing that happened was Nikki went through addiction. She didn't drink till she was 21. And she ended up, she took off to the races. Once that alcohol got in her system, and if you had told me, we all would have betted it would have been the older one that would have been the drinker, and the younger one just very quiet and sweet, and she just ended up vodka in her purse everywhere you went, you know. And it was like, probably she dealt with that for about 5 years, and ended up in the emergency room a couple times where she had to be fed intravenously and everything. So those were tough times. But I got to tell you about real quickly with this thing with Jennifer at the school. When she graduated from high school, we went to give this assistant principal a gift for finding her in the bathroom and helping her through this. And I said, we brought her this little angel. And she said, what's this for? And I said, well, you were the angel in our life that helped us that night when Jennifer had to go to the emergency room. And she said, you're giving me a gift? I said, yeah, why? She said, I should be giving the two of you a gift. I said, what are you talking about? She said, you don't know how many people, how many kids in the school have alcohol and drug problems, and I just see their parents and them grow further and further and further apart, more and more problems all the time. You're in this office a bunch of times. All I have observed for the last 3 years, because this happened her freshman year, was the love grow between you two. What is your secret? And I laughed and I said, really, you want to know? And she said, because I had seen this assistant principal at a Course of Miracle workshop one time, so I knew she was on a spiritual path. I said, I'm a recovering alcoholic, drug addict. She goes, I knew there was something very special. She said, well, congratulations, you've done a good job, Mom. And that was really nice to hear. It was nice to hear that we may be the only big book that somebody reads, and it's a wonderful book to read, right? So anyway, where I am today, is life's good. I never saw Michael coming in my life. I never saw you guys all coming in my life. I never saw the House of Venetia coming in my life. I never knew I was going to retire in January of 2021. But God had a plan that I didn't. And it's worked perfectly. What's funny is Michael tells you his side of the story where he was into meditation and my name came to him. And I was, when he told me that story, I just went like, you've got to be kidding, because I'm sitting in my meditation chair and saying, God, my picker's broken. Just bring them to me. And I said, I couldn't believe it, because for those of you who are keep hungering after a relationship, just realize God answers in three ways. It's not yet. Okay, here you go. And no. And it was not yet with Michael and I. And I had the best 3 years. I had been with somebody, but I had 3 years where I just went out with the girlfriends, had a great time, didn't worry about a relationship, really put it in God's hands. And then when he called, I knew, because I knew about him through friends. I went, this is out of the blue that this guy's calling me. I said, okay. And I used to say to God, I don't get it, God, because you know, I really want to, before I leave the planet, I want to be in a successful, happy relationship, and I want to have a home again with somebody. And God heard my prayers, and that's why I'm here with all of you. And I just feel so blessed. I love you all, and thank you for inviting me into your lives and sharing your sobriety with me. Thank you.
There's probably some food left out there.